You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hello, and welcome to a special bonus episode of Fly on the Call. Today, I'll be sharing some of my favorite clips from the first year of the podcast. For new listeners, this will be a great starting point, highlighting some of my favorite artists and conversations while giving you a feel for the show. If you've been around from the start, maybe this will jog your memory of an awesome episode or get you to go back and listen to one you missed. Today's lineup includes Silverstein, Meet Me at the Altar, Spanish Love Songs, Origami Angel, Glass Beach, Proper, and The Wonder Years. And stick around until the end for a sneak peek of tomorrow's episode with Barty Strange, whose recently released album Live Forever is one of the best of the year. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. We're starting things off with Silverstein. I had an awesome conversation with lead singer Shane Told, celebrating the 10-year anniversary of their album A Shipwreck in the Sand, and came up with some never-discussed tidbits like this one. On, like, allmusic.com, it shows Silverstein's original guitarist Richard McWalter as having, like, a composing credit on the end. Is that in any way accurate?
Yes! Great! Wow! That's really, really, wow, that's really astute of you. Richard was our original guitar player, and he's amazing. He's an amazing person, and an amazing guitar player, so creative. And to me, like, you know, he was the most important part of our band when we started. I think he was the reason that we stood out, because some of the guitar parts he wrote were so cool, you know, whether it's like the intro and outro to Wish I Could Forget You, which is, you know, really cool, clean part that he wrote. And, you know, he's amazing. We recorded the 6-song, you know, demo EP. And after that, we had a few other things that Richard had written and, you know, me and him were working on together. And one of them was The End. And Richard wrote the music for that. And it was in a really strange tuning, where you tune the top, like the low string, you tune it actually up to F, which is very, like, up a semitone, which is a very, very unconventional thing to do to a guitar. It's been a very strange tuning. And I was really intrigued by the way that it sounded. So, you know, when Rich left the band, I said, hey man, so, you know, that acoustic song you wrote, I really like it. And I really, it's your song and whatever. I'd really like to use it. If that's okay. So keep in mind, this is like the year 2001. So, like, we're still 2 years away from our first album even coming out. But I said, I'd really like to, you know, use this song. So I remember I listened to the, like, shitty, like, ghetto blaster demo that we had made for the song, and I figured out how to play it. And he told me what the tuning was, because I wouldn't be able to figure it out without knowing what the tuning was. So I figured out this song, and I remember I had one of the first titles was called Learning to Hurt. Was one of the first titles I wrote with a bunch of different lyrics, sort of different melodies. And I had this kind of idea of the song. So when we were doing the first album, I actually tracked a scratch guitar, for that song, for The End, which turned into The End. And so the first album, it was supposed to be on the first album. It was supposed to be the last track. And we were going to cut, what song were we going to cut from the first album? I can't remember. Might have been November, actually. We were going to cut November because we wanted to make a 10 song album, and we were going to have The End would have been the last track. And I remember, I recorded all the guitar, and then Paul recorded the drums, like the ending drum thing, which was different, but not that much different. And yeah, so sorry, I'm going on and on about this, but I never talked about this before. And
no, super interesting.
So, yeah, so that, I don't know. In the end, I don't know what happened. I think we kind of ran out of time. The first record was made kind of crazy too. Like we kind of ran out of time on the first album, and then when it came time, so I kind of just forgot about it. And then when it came time to make the second record with Discovering the Waterfront, I was like, hey, remember this acoustic song? And everyone's like, oh yeah, yeah. I'm like, I think it's really good. Like, I think we should put it on the record. And again, I demoed it. And again, like we recorded the guitar for it. And then again, it just, I don't know, it just didn't end up getting finished.
Oh, wow.
And then the third record, I think we didn't bother trying it. I think that like we were like, this ship has sailed. And then when the fourth record was, you know, Shipwreck in the Sand was, we were writing that, I was like, okay. So I know this song is like literally 7 years old, and it hasn't worked out, but I'm like, I really think there's something here, and I would like to, you know, actually do this one this time. And Cameron, because he produced Shipwreck in the Sand and he produced Discovering the Waterfront, he remembered the acoustic song from Discovering the Waterfront. Like he remembered recording it, and he was like, oh yeah, that actually like is a pretty cool, like, you know, that's got a cool vibe to it, so like maybe we should do it. So finally that happened, and I remember I played it for Rich, because we're still like Rich, I still see Rich, like he lives in Boston area now, and we still see him like when we're out there and stuff. So we've been friends like the whole time, and I remember he was living in Australia at the time, and this is before the record came out. We were in Australia, I guess probably beginning of 2009, and I played it for him, and he laughed, and he said, "Dude," and he's like, "That's like you've like played it completely wrong." So like I had referenced like the tape, the cassette tape recording that he just made like for me. Or not even for me, just made like in the year 2000. And he's like, oh yeah, that's like that chord you play there is that's like not the right chord or whatever. And it, like, of course it doesn't really matter, but it's just funny that I, you know, just played it. I played it like, you know, maybe not wrong, but different from, you know, what he had originally written. So there you go. That's why, yeah, he's got a songwriting credit, 'cause he wrote all the music for that song.
Meet Me at the Altar are one of the breakout artists of 2020. Here's vocalist Edith Johnson talking about confidence and what drives her to be the representation she wants to see in music.
I read in an interview too, where Edith, you said, you know, how you love being in a band full of women of color, and because that was something that you like never had growing up. Where does that confidence come from? What led you to feel like kind of empowered in order to, you know, be this band that has like these such big plans that, you know, you're able to kind of like go out and just like make it happen?
Yeah, so lack of is something that really motivates me. And whenever, I don't know, I was just, my parents raised me to be a very strong Black woman who can do anything. They always told me that I can do absolutely anything I set my mind to. And I was like going to shows and, you know, seeing all my favorite bands, one day I noticed, and I was just like, why am I not doing this? Because, you know, I have the talent, I have the voice, and there needs to be more representation. So I like set out a mission to find people like me to do it with, because it's, representation is so, so important. Mm-hmm. So important, especially for young minds and young girls. And because not everyone's like us. Like I said, lack of is such an empowering thing for us. It makes us even more ambitious, but you know, not everyone's like that. They might see the scene and get discouraged and be like, well, I don't see anyone there like me, so I can't do it.
And is it ever like a weight on your shoulders for all of you, kind of like being those, you know, the ones that are being like, you know, held up as like this example of this?
I think it's the opposite. we feel like it's our duty almost, in a good way. Because we want to be that for, you know, the little black girls who are sitting in their rooms listening to pop punk who think there's no one out there like me. Because we were that people. You know, not just black and brown. Even little white girls, because...
yeah, even women in general.
There's a severe lack of women in the scene.
A lack, yeah.
Especially women of color. So it's like, it's really cool for us to be able to do what we love and get to be that representation at the same time. It's like hand in hand. And for us, we're the type of people that, like, if we want something, we're gonna make it happen, regardless of if we have help or not. Which is literally how we've, you know, gotten everything that we have today. So it's cool for us to be able to do it the hard way so that other people don't have to.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I mean, Tyranny as a song was kind of about, you know, you being underestimated as a band or as people. And I'm curious, how has it kind of been for you, you know, especially as you're hitting these milestones, how has it been like navigating, you know, a music industry that's like the majority, you know, straight white men?
It's been, I feel like it's probably possibly going to get a little bit more difficult as we grow in size. But also, we have had a couple of weird interactions. It's just, it's a lot of weird backhanded comments that I hope that the people that say those says aren't doing it on purpose and, like, don't realize. But we've had a lot of, like, oh, like, you play better than me and you're a girl. Or we've had, like, we've walked into a venue before and they've been like, oh, girl's door's not open yet. That's happened twice. And one time we were sitting in a green room at a show we were playing, and one of the touring members of the band we were opening for was like, this is a green room and it's for bands only. Are you supposed to be in here? It's just like ridiculous stuff like that. And when you go to a show, we do get weird looks sometimes. And then it hasn't really been super outwardly racist or super outwardly sexist. But it's like these weird backhand comments that people tell us that's just like, do you know what you're saying? Like, do you know what you sound like right now?
People definitely underestimate us. Like, as soon as they see us go on that stage, they definitely expect that we're gonna not be, you know, like, as good as we are type thing. Like, they're gonna expect us to just do horrible just because we're girls. And it's like, no, like, we know what we're doing and you should expect more from us. Not just because we're girls, we're gonna be bad.
I've had someone ask me if I was a merch girl for this other band. I was just like, he was like, can I buy some of so-and-so's merch? And I was like, I don't know, go talk to them.
Oh, was that in Chicago?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's like we, even like there's good and bad in everything. It's not just us who experience it. But we don't let it really get to us because we know it's going to be there. But also we know that we have to navigate through this to get to the point to where we're the ones who are able to make it a safe space for everyone. Because like even, you know, listeners as fans, we've sometimes been the only, you know, people of color in the venue. So it's like, it sucks that it's inevitable, but it is inevitable. Just, you know, this is the world that we live in, but we're still gonna do it, and we're gonna do it with a positive attitude, and it's not gonna be this way forever, and we're gonna be one of the bands that's making that change.
Spanish Love Songs put out what is probably my favorite album of the year so far, with Brave Faces Everyone. Dolores is one of the hardest hitting tracks on the record, so it was one I made sure we discussed.
Another song that I kind of wanted to hit on is Dolores, which I feel like is kind of, lyrically, I feel like it's kind of one of the heaviest songs on the album. So I was just curious to hear a little bit about that and the way that one came together.
So Dolores, like during pre-production, was, and maybe I'll release like a clip of it someday, but it was like a mid-tempo kind of Americana rock song. But like this bouncy chorus. And we tracked it that way, and we really liked it. Even though we thought it sounded a bit like a country song, like the working title was like Country Road as a joke. And like, unfortunately it stayed that way when we sent it to the label. And so everybody kept calling it Country Road. And I was like, oh God damn it. And then we got into the studio and we started tracking drums. And the day before we were going to track drums, Ruben and I ran through everything one more time. And we played it, and I was like, this sucks. This is not a good song.
That sounds like a pattern for you.
Yeah, it drives everyone insane. And I had like a little reverb pedal that I just got, and I was messing around with it, which it didn't even end up on the album. But I played a version with just two chords, just me. And Ruben immediately was like, yeah, so you're going to do that one. Like, that's what we need to do. And the rest of the band was like working on stuff back in Kyle's apartment. And we got back there and said, we're idiots. Why would we change this thing that we already have that we pre-produced? Like, cause the point of pre-production is to practice the songs. So then when it's a dry run, so you go to the studio, you know what you're doing, right? And you can explore things instead of trying to figure out the songs. And so, like, we were recording drums in Orange County, and I have like a little production like groove box, and I was like recording organ pads on it and structuring it and doing like little drum loop. Like, people thought I was crazy. And so our last day recording drums, we set aside half the day, and Ruben and I fleshed it out, and that kind of took its structure that way. And then from there, it all kind of fell into place and became what it is, which is not a upbeat country song.
And as far as like lyrically, I feel like it's like I said, it's like really hard hitting, and I think it's one of the ones that like when it finally like hit me, like it really hit me hard. Just, like, how did that, like, the lyric side of things come together for you?
You know, I was just writing. I went off on, like, it was one of the last things I wrote lyrically for the album. I think it was that and then Kick. Like, those were the last two things I did. It was just something I had written down. And I know on Schmaltz, we had a song where I was trying to tackle a similar subject. And when we got into the studio, I scrapped the lyrics completely because they were bad. And that song became El Nino Considers His Failures. So, like, it was a completely different song about, like, mass shootings and America and stuff like that. And I struggled for a long time to find a way to talk about it than somebody like being at a song being like, guns are bad, you know? Like, no shit. Like, I don't know. And so I found a way in, which is just through a story of nurses working, you know, working the shift after a shooting. I remember I wrote it down because we're all working, and it was when the Texas shootings happened this year, like the back-to-back shootings. And so I was just like, cool, like, here we go, here we are again, another album, and, you know, all the same shit's happening. And so it was just, yeah, it was a way to kind of get into it and just kind of vent some frustration. And just tying into the theme of the album of like just empathizing with people who are seeing it from another perspective and another side. You know, and largely working in a place where, like, I mean, that story ostensibly takes place in Texas, right? So, like, working in a place where people probably aren't as anti-gun as I myself might be, but still seeing the kind of ravages that these things wreck on humanity, you know?
Origami Angel's Somewhere City is some of the most positive and energetic music in recent memory. Fly on the Call got the lowdown on the concept behind the album.
I read that, like, you've had the idea for, like, Somewhere City for kind of like close to 2 years, and that it was like originally going to be an EP before you were like convinced to make it an LP. How did like the original idea kind of come about, and like, would you call it a concept record?
Yeah. Okay. So definitely I've always kind of wanted to do a theme, like a location based theme, you know? I've always just been obsessed with the more like the higher arching theme of escapism and like how it is just presented, especially like in culture right now. I think like everything is a form of escapism, whether it's like memes or Marvel movies or, you know, anything like that, and any video game or sort of that. And I think our music has always kind of touched on that and spoken to that. But I remember sitting one night and thinking about an idea for an EP where the whole thing is location based and the whole thing is just about like different perspectives towards that escape, I guess. And just the comfortness, like the comforting factor that would be like able to be explored within an album like that. And I like you said, I did originally have the idea for an EP and I was pitching around to people, and this was a while back, so I don't think anybody took me seriously. but then I remember I wrote the riff. So I had some of the songs, like the beginning of Say Less, the part where it's just guitar and vocals and stuff like that, and where it cuts in and it's like a little dancey riff. I had everything but the chorus for that in about like this time of the year, 2017. And that was like one of the first things I had written for the record. I knew I wanted to have that be on a thing. I don't know. It was a little weird, but I think it was around last February. I sent Lex from Chatterbot. She's also our manager. I sent her the beginning riff of Welcome To. And I was like, I sent it on a voice memo, or it might have even been a video of me singing it and just playing it, no drums, but with an electric guitar and all that. And I was like, hey, thought this would be a really cool thing for like the first song on an EP called Somewhere City. And it would be a concept record about, or a concept EP about, you know, a city and location, about themes of escape. And I sent that at like 4 o'clock in the morning, and I woke up at 8 to Lex being like, Ryland, you need to wake up right now. Ryland, you need to wake up. You need to, and then like just pitched this idea to me about like, take this, make it an LP. It'll be so fucking sick. And I was like, okay, you know, Lex usually know what's good. So there were some other projects that we had developing after that. Well, that idea kind of stayed in my head as, this is what I want the concept to be, this is what I want our themes to be. And then as I developed songs, just trying to fit like those parts into the LP and see where we could go from that. As far as a concept record, I definitely think it is a loose concept album. And when I say loose and concept, I don't know, it's weird. It's a concept album that doesn't necessarily have to be tied to the concept, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's like, sure. It's a little more, I would say it's not as thorough as certain concept records have been in the past. Mm-hmm. In terms of the one dialogue, whereas it's more like there's a couple different points of view there that we discuss, like 4 or 5 that I think are all sort of different angles, mm-hmm, of the same end goal, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, definitely.
For example, the song Escape Rope for me is the beginning of side two of the record. And it's sort of like, it's definitely the most negative song on the record. And it sounds like almost petty at points. And that transitions right into the title track, which is one of the more overwhelmingly positive songs on the record. And then the record kind of ends positively from that note. Escape Rope is a point of view where it's like, from an outsider, I think, like someone who might not understand what a certain person is going through on the first side of the record, or understand a lot of the dialogue, and kind of is upset at someone for leaving, or upset at someone for embarking on their own journey, which I think is just as valid of a narrative to sort of explore as one where we are just talking about the journey itself. That was one that really fascinated me. It's one of the last 3 songs, I think, on the record that I wrote was Escape Rope. And I remember writing and I was like, I'm kind of getting tired of this one narrative that we're exploring. I kind of want to explore the opposite of it and see how far we could get with that. that one is definitely the most different, but it still serves a purpose to the overall angle of the record, I guess. Mm-hmm. So it's weird when the word concept record starts to get thrown around, because it's definitely not a rock opera. You know, it's no like no Tommy. It's not as I'd say it's not as thorough as for example, like Cosmic Thrill Seekers that came out this year. Mm-hmm. Like, that's such a good concept album that is devoted to its narrative, and how solid that is and how solid they pulled it off is so amazing. And it's I don't think we could have done something as thorough as that with the record that we wrote. Ours is definitely a little more not as tied down to that one concept. Mm-hmm. But still a theme. I don't know. It's a theme record, maybe. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I was kind of going to say something like that, where it's like, it's not like a record where it's just like 10 songs, but it's also not just like one story. It's kind of like in between, like exploring that theme, like you said.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's kind of what the whole city idea is too. It's just like a city is not just going to be one type of person and one type of dialogue and one type of journey. It's going to be filled with thousands of them, really. Of all different people, all different stories, all different backgrounds. And I think that the songs are more of they're more individual viewpoints in that community of songs, if that makes sense.
Glass Beach is one of the most unique bands with one of the most passionate fan bases I can think of. We discussed making an album, genrelessness, and the democratization of music.
It feels like a very like album-oriented album.
Yep.
And so I'm curious about kind of like that process of like kind of fitting all the various pieces together, especially with how broad of a sound there is.
Yeah, it was a puzzle. It was pretty complicated to get everything. I mean, when I think you're right about it being an album, like I say that there are musicians who write songs and there are musicians who write albums, and neither is like necessarily better, but I've always considered myself more of an album writer. Mm-hmm. So when we were writing the individual songs, like we didn't have like the track list, like the track order, like mm-hmm. figured out from the beginning, but we did have an idea of like, okay, this should probably go after a slower song, mm-hmm. or maybe lead into this song. And we knew Classic J Dies and Goes to Hell Part One was going to be the first song, and we mm-hmm. knew Orchids was going to be the last song, like almost from the beginning, like pretty much from when we first wrote those.
So when we say new, we were always open for like, but if we write a song that like will be a better opener or a better closer, we were like open to it. It just never happened. Yeah. Those just like we're locked in there, and like some of the songs changed like pretty drastically tonally. Like Dallas was like a different feeling song at different points throughout the production, so like that was why like the middle of the album was always so like amorphous until we like figured it out. Something was done.
Dallas is an interesting one, especially because some of these songs have kind of like a ship of Theseus situation with them, where I wrote the song and I changed it and I changed that and I changed that and I changed it so much that the final version of the song has absolutely no musical material in common with the first version of it. But the sequencing was really just a matter of like, I would listen to each song, and then when it was over, I was like, okay, what song do I want to hear now? You know, it's very...
Or sometimes even just like, what sound do I want to hear now? And then you would make that sound go into the next song. Because like, this isn't Rat Castle, it goes into... what does Rat Castle go into?
Planetarium,
yeah. It's just like noise into noise.
Yeah. And there were a few where I planned out like specific direct mm-hmm. transitions between them, because I love that. I love when one song just like morphs into another song.
For sure. So I mean, was it like once you had kind of like the main parts of the songs, was it kind of like figuring out the transitions in between? Did that kind of like change as you figured out the track listing, or were the songs like more complete before you saw how they would best be sequenced?
It kind of all happened at the same time, because it was just like pieces here. And like when Jay said it was a puzzle, that's a really good like way to put it, because like you're doing like a big puzzle and you get a chunk of it that looks like it's in the middle and you realize it's on the right side.
Yeah.
But that chunk is mostly good, but then you have to add other parts to that. So yeah, it really all kind of happened around each other.
Yeah. Yeah. There would be stuff where it's like, okay, these three songs are really good next to each other, but mm-hmm. is that 3, 4, 5, or is that 10, 11, 12, or, mm-hmm. you know, And yeah, just putting it together a little bit at a time. I mean, the sequencing came together as the tracks did. Like you said. Yeah.
In the like Bandcamp like blurb description for the album, you talk about kind of like genrelessness and like the democratization of music and stuff. And yeah. I feel like it's somewhat related the way it seems like in some ways the album's like polarizing, like either you get it and you love it or you're like, I have no idea what the hell's going on.
I give up.
So like, could you expand on that idea of like democratization of music and stuff and just like how it kind of influenced you?
Yeah. So what I was kind of getting at there is I feel like more and more, I mean, I feel like this has been going on for a while, but I really think people are starting to care a lot less about genre with music. And I feel like that's because a lot of the dividers that used to be between different genres are kind of going away. Mm-hmm. 'Cause it used to be a matter of like, you know, if you lived in, I mean, you'd listen to your local scene or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Or would play it on your local radio.
Like, yeah, like styles of music were very tied to places. They were very tied to identities and stuff. But now, for the most part, people are listening to music on Spotify, like mm-hmm. Bandcamp and stuff like that, where there's really no divider between genres. It's just another way of describing the music. And I feel like people are branching out a lot more because music outside of like what they would have listened to before is becoming more accessible to people. Mm-hmm. And what I was saying about democratization of music is now like you don't need a label to get your music to everybody in the world. You know, and any like any random Bandcamp artist has like, you know, they have just as much a chance of blowing up as any major label artist. You know, it's just a matter of the right people finding it and sharing it. A lot of the barriers aren't there, you know, and I just feel we kind of embrace the increasing lack of barriers in music, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's super freeing because we get to say like, no matter what, we know that we can put this in front of people.
Yeah.
Like we have access to that. And so we can make what we want. And if it is good, people will like it. And if enough people like it, then they'll like share it. And
that's the other thing. Like the internet is so much easier to find a niche. So mm-hmm. like whatever weird art you want to make, the like, even if it's like 20 people who would like it, the 20 mm-hmm. people in the world who would like it will find it. You know?
And it'll be great to know that they like it. Like, it's,
yeah.
Yeah.
Proper's lyrics hit fast and hard in a way that doesn't often happen in rock genres. Here's more on the mindset behind the bars and making a point not to self-censor.
I read in one of the interviews you did about The Suburbs Ruined My Life, you were saying basically that like the most important thing to you was having good bars and kind of everything else in writing was like secondary.
Yeah.
Did that kind of hold true coming into this album?
Oh yeah. Yeah. 'Cause I kind of had that fear of like, am I going to be able to top my first album? 'Cause you know, I had years to write the first record. I wrote it at like 22 where I was like my most angry. And I was like, everyone was just like, oh man, like these songs are so good. You're so angry. And like, that would be the repeating theme. And I just was like, can I write something that's not angry and still be just as good, if not better. So, but also wanting to just like better bars, harder punchlines, like just like a rapper would just be like trying to like have every opening line just be immediately like catches your ear or just immediately ridiculous to where you're just like, what did they say? So just trying to approach it like I need to do better than last time, but also not lose my mind in the process.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely like, I guess I would call it maybe like a lyrical density to the band.
It's kind of like, thank you.
Once it's like a train, like once it starts going, you can't really stop. Could you like talk a little bit more about kind of like that style and how you like developed it?
I just, man, just from talking shit, honestly, just from talking some shit. And then like, 'cause it used to be, I would just write so many words, so many verses. And then like, when I kind of like got more into learning about song structure, like, and not just cramming everything I can into like a 3-minute song and like actually structuring it and being like, oh, well, a bridge would be good here. Like actual pacing yourself is that's what I had to learn. So it used to be, I'd write like eight verses and I was like, there's no way this song is going to be under 6 minutes long. And then I would actually like write the song. I would play a 7 minute song back when I was just an acoustic artist. And it would just be like, I can tell that I'm losing people right now every second. So it was a lot of dialing that back. And then just again, from like for movies, just like show, don't tell. So like learning about exposition and how to just like say a lot in a little bit of time. And then going back to rap, saying a lot with a lot of ridiculous bars that catch your attention and also a little bit of time. So it just kind of went from doing too much and then just like you know, what's that quote? Like, how do you sculpt? Like you get a giant stone and you chip away everything that's not what you have in mind. So just going from there, which it took a long time. I think I've been writing lyrics for 11 years now. And it just, I feel like the last 3 years where I finally felt like I know what I'm like 100% doing and not just like, well, this one isn't that great, but everything else is fine. Like I'm happy with every part of a song and learning that I can have the music complement the song and not just be the backdrop. I can do a little like lick here and there instead of just having to stuff that part with like all these words. Yeah, just learning to pace myself.
Yeah, I mean, that's really cool that you can kind of, like, track that progress along the way and stuff, too.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, like, kind of chipping back at stuff, like, the gang vocals and, like, New Year's resolutions, and I spent the winter writing songs about getting better. They're, like, so kind of, like, simple, but, like, so powerful at the same time, and I think that...
Thank you.
Those are, like, standout moments on the album, too, in addition to, like, really sick lines that you guys have.
Thank you. Yeah, that was the goal, because the last record, I think, I did harmonies on almost every song. I tried to put gang vocals everywhere. And this time I was just like, I can do less with more. Like places where you think that gang vocals should be, I can just not do that and put like a really sick guitar part instead or like keys or something. So thank you. That was definitely the goal this time around.
As far as like the lyrical content and you being like so open and personal with your lyrics, is there like anywhere that you kind of like hold back a little bit, or like where do you kind of like draw the line with what you include versus what you don't?
No, like I roasted my own family. There's nothing past that. Really, because I don't have too many like second drafts. Like once I write something, like it I don't really change it. Like that's it. I think maybe like the most thing I'll change is like the song title. That's where I have the most like, because ASAP Rocky Type Beat was originally going to be called The Hippocratic Oath, and I was like, oh, but that's like our first single, I want it to be something that people are just like, why is this called this? So I just, that's what I'll like think of mostly now. But just for, I don't know, I can't think of anything where I've just been like, oh, I shouldn't write that. Like I've always just like my first draft is what I go with, especially with how like I'll think of the whole album before I actually start writing it. I'm like, well, this goes into this narrative, so this has to be it. I'll have like lot of like fear of my family hearing it, and then I just have to get over it.
The last of the greatest hits clips comes from the Wonder Years, my personal favorite band of all time. I spoke to frontman Dan Campbell earlier this year about a variety of things, including Burst into K2, 10 Years of the Upsides, and his work ethic.
That kind of like works into just about kind of like your overall like work ethic. Like Sundrance Pavement Society last year was kind of supposed to be a way to keep fans engaged during like a slower time for the band, and it kind of ended up being just as busy as any other year for you. So like, would you consider yourself a workaholic?
You know, it's not like a thing I had really thought much about until I was reading these questions a few minutes ago. Also, I was like, oh, I'll read these things, you know, a day or two before the interview. And then the Bernie lyric idea came up, and that took up my whole day yesterday. But as I was texting my wife, and I was like, okay, I think I only have like another 150 to go. And she was like, you're such a fucking masochist. And I was like, what do you mean? She's like, are you kidding me? Do you remember when you did 4 shows in 24 hours? Like, do you remember when you, like, all of these, like, insane ideas that you have? And yeah, I guess I really do. I like working. I like to work. I like to feel productive. It makes my brain feel better when I am accomplishing things. And so, like, I start every day with a to-do list, and I just as quickly as possible and start another one. I have a tendency to be the person that's like, if I have like a slow couple of days, I'll be in the shower thinking like, I could probably start another band and a podcast and a clothing company and a nonprofit, right? you know, and then I'll like get to work on one or two of them, and then like a fucking ocean of Wonder Years or Aaron West or anything else stuff will land, and I'll have to get back to work on that even harder now with the baby too. So
for sure. Yeah, and I mean, I feel like as a fan, that's been something that's been really exciting to see throughout the whole career. And I'm just curious, like, how does it play into the fan base, you feel like, and like the way that they connect to the band and the music?
Well, I think that, one, we're very lucky because the fan base has been like incredibly dedicated. I don't think there are a lot of bands that get the longevity that we have and that are still just, again, nerd shit, but looking over like the data from this tour, we're up from, you know, 2 years ago or the last time we did these markets. It's like, it's kind of crazy to have such, I mean, or it's just so lucky to have such a dedicated fan base that they kind of rides with us through whatever crazy idea we have. Like, there's not, when we said to, you know, we're thinking about the four shows in 24 hours thing a lot this week because we were talking to Free Throw about it and trying to walk them through how it was like physically possible. Mm-hmm. And then we started saying, could we do six next time? So table that, maybe. But, you know, there are not a lot of fan bases that'll go, oh, you want to do four shows in 24 hours? Sure, I'll come to a show where doors are at 1 a.m. or 10 a.m, which two of the shows were. Like, you know, we feel lucky that we have people that are like, yeah, I'll indulge your stupid fucking idea, guys.
Can you walk me through a little bit of, like, the process for the reimaginings? I mean, I know, like, on the second volume especially, there's a lot more experimentation, especially with, like, Washington Square Park, which kind of takes on, you know, a very different, like, context.
Yeah, I think obviously the first step is, like, picking songs, and we just try to look at the whole breadth of the catalog and say, like, okay, like, let's make sure we're spreading it out. Like, we don't want to do seven songs off of No Closer to Heaven or something like that. Like, let's make sure we're getting the whole thing. And so we're going through each record by record and saying, like, okay, like, are people going to be interested in another version of this? And are we interested in another version of this? And if the answer to both of those is yes, then can we do an interesting version of this song? Mm-hmm. So that we assembled what we thought was the track list. And then we kind of just go in and say, okay, like, thesis statement for this one. What do you want to do to it? Like, does anyone have an idea for, like, the guiding light to how we're going to get this song to a different place? Mm-hmm. And so just song by song, we go through that. And then we went into the studio with Ace Enders and Nick Cazzese and at Lumberyard and kind of went through it with them, showed them the ideas, listened to their input, and went to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you mentioned, like, doing it with Ace at Lumberyard, and I know that's kind of where a lot of the Aaron West stuff comes together as well. Was that project something that, like, influenced the idea for the first one or the process of either of them?
I think that the only thing that I could say, like, it categorically influenced was going to Ace. was just knowing, you know, hey, here's somebody reasonably local that I know that at that point, like, I worked really well with and Michael worked really well with, is he traps and drums on the Aaron West stuff. And, and we're like, let's try it. Let's give that a shot. And, well, we had Vince Roddy mix both of them and thought he did an amazing job on both. And we're really happy with how all that came out.
Yeah. And were there any, like, songs that you kind of wanted to have on either of the volumes that you just kind of couldn't crack, like, the deconstructing of?
I think the only one that had gotten brought up and then we were like, wait, this isn't going to work was Kennedy really wanted to do You Made Me Want to Be a Saint from Suburbia. Mm-hmm. And we were like, okay, how can we make this song that has a literal blast beat in it work acoustic or, like, stripped down or, like, whatever you want to call it, vibey or however we define these songs? Because I don't want to define them just by, like, the guitar that's being played. I think they're more than that. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, we were just like, that might be too tall a task right now. Let's table that one. Maybe we come back to it at a different verse of the game.
And finally, as promised, here's a clip from tomorrow's episode with Barcheese Strange. Be sure to hit that subscribe button so you don't miss it, and follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at FlyInTheCallPod to stay up to date on all the exciting things to come.
Take me back to when you're heading out to record the album. How are you kind of feeling? How did things flow? What was the energy like in the barn?
I just, you know, I remember wanting to record the record, and, you know, I had reached out to Jamie in December and said, like, you know, hey, like, I've got this song that I like, and I'm about to go record a record, and I really want to work with you. And I was really excited because I had a really clear picture of what I thought the record could be, and I remember what getting the players together, everyone was just really excited. Like, we all kind of went into it with this idea that we wanted to, like, we weren't thinking, oh, let's make like the best record or anything. We were just like pumped to make it together. It was like me, Brian D'Amelio, Carter, Zumtobel, you know, Dylan, God, what's his last name? He plays for, shit. I'm horrible. I'm forgetting everything. Anyways, Justin Foster, all types of people from Brooklyn were in the room. It was pretty sick. And, you know, we were all in different bands, and we had just always been like, oh, like, it'd be so sick to be in a band together or to play together or to, like, do something. He plays an alto polo there. Dylan Tracy. Sorry. Goddamn. It was, like, one of my best friends. I could not let that go. I was like, no. Anyways, yeah, like, you know, it was just all these people that, you know, I've really respected and always wanted to play with, and finally got us all in a room, and we were just like, yo, let's track it. Let's do it ourselves. Let's mix it ourselves. Let's kind of prove to ourselves that we know what we're doing, you know, and that's what we did. It was like a fun experiment for all of us. And, you know, it was really exciting because it was kind of like a dream, you know, like, oh yeah, let's leave in the wintertime and go to upstate New York and record a record in a barn. You know, it felt very fairy tale-y, and I was stoked to be able to like organize it and like, you know, it'd be my music. So it was cool.
Thanks so much for listening to this special bonus episode. I hope it hit on some of your favorites and gave you something new to dig into as well. Fly on the Call is brought to you by Sound Talent Media. A special thank you as always to The Alternative for helping to promote the show, Kaylin West of Tiny Stills for the theme song, and Michaela Jane Palermo for the artwork. You can keep up to date by subscribing to the podcast and following the show on Twitter and Instagram at FlyOnTheCallPod. Feel free to email any questions, comments, or other feedback to me at flyonthecallpod@gmail.com. Black Lives Matter. Please vote this November.
Hello out there!
Yes, hello out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together, we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hyden, Backstreet's Magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Menahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!